And hello, kids, this is the Count, once again, bringing you the Halloween program for the Children's Story Hour. Oh, kids, we've got a really scary program for you today. Let me explain. First, we're going to find out about Curious George, and he goes to a costume party. And then, kids, it's going to be Halloween stories, scary short stories for kids. And then, one of my favorites, Jerry Seinfeld. Ow! Jerry Seinfeld, Halloween. And then, Roald Dahl's scary stories. And one story called On the Brighton Road. And finally, we'll finish the Halloween program with Scary Stories Treasury. Woo! So sit back and be scared to death. Ow!
Curious George goes to a costume party. This is George. He was a good little monkey and always very curious. One day, George and his friend, the man with the yellow hat, were on their way to a party at Mrs. Gray's house. George could not wait. He liked parties, and he was looking forward to seeing Mrs. Gray. But when the door opened, George did not see Mrs. Gray at all. He saw a witch. "Don't be afraid, George," said the man with the yellow hat. "This witch is our friend." The witch took off her mask. It was Mrs. Gray, after all. "Oh, dear," she said, "did I forget to tell you this was a costume party?" George had never been to a costume party before. Inside, he saw more people than he knew. They were all wearing costumes. There was his friend Betsy, dressed up like an astronaut. And was that Bill? Why, he looked just like a mummy. George wanted to wear a costume, too. "I have some dress-up clothes upstairs," said Mrs. Gray. "Would you like to use them to make a costume, George?" Mrs. Gray took George to a room with a big trunk filled with clothes. "Well, borrow anything you like, George," she said. "I have just the thing for your friend downstairs." George tried on lots of costumes. The first was too big. The next was too small. Another was too silly, and this one was too scary. At last, George found a costume that was just right. George was a rodeo cowboy. He wore a vest and pants with fringe. He even had a lasso and a hat. If only he could see himself in the mirror. George was curious. Could he see himself if he stood on the bed? No, he needed to jump higher. George bounced on the bed just a little, but still he couldn't see. He bounced a little more and a little more. Soon, George was having so much fun, he forgot all about looking in the mirror. He bounced as high as he could until, crash! George bounced off the bed. He smashed into the night table and got tangled up in the tablecloth. Suddenly, everything went dark. George heard the people downstairs gasp. What was that? Was that a ghost? A ghost? George did not want to meet up with a ghost alone. He dashed out of the room and down the hall. He wanted to get back to his friend in a hurry, and he knew the fastest way. He hopped onto the stair rail and sailed whoosh down the stairs. Keep in mind that George is now wearing a sheet that's completely covering him. "It is a ghost," someone screamed. Everyone turned. They looked scared, and they were looking at George. The ghost must be right behind him. George flew off the rail and landed plop in the arms of a farmer. But this wasn't really a farmer. It was his friend, the man with the yellow hat. Soon everyone stopped looking scared and started to laugh. "That's not a ghost, that's a cowboy," laughed a policeman. "That's not a cowboy, that's a monkey," giggled the princess. "That's not just any monkey," said Betsy, "it's Curious George." Everyone clapped and cheered. They liked George's Halloween trick.
"Oh, you gave us a good scare, George," said Mrs. Gray, "and I'm glad to see you found some interesting costumes. Now, why don't I take your ghost outfit so you can join the party?"
After the guest bobbed for apples, lit jack-o'-lanterns, and played some party games, prizes for the best costumes were handed out. There was one prize for Betsy, and one for Bill, and two for Curious George.
"You were the best ghost and the best cowboy, George," said Mrs. Gray.
Everyone had a good time at the party, especially George. Too soon, it was time to say goodbye.
"Good night, George. Happy Halloween."
Now I'm going to read some stories from a book titled Halloween Stories, Scary Short Stories for Kids. The Wicked Witch. Halloween was fast approaching, and I wanted to be the one to scare the pants off my best friend, Tricia. On previous Halloweens, she was always the one that ended up scaring the pants off me. So I just wanted to return the favor. I thought long and hard about what I wanted to be that Halloween, and I decided that I wanted to be a wicked witch. I didn't want to be just any wicked witch, though. I wanted to be a wicked witch, complete with broom, long pointy nose, and the most important part, I wanted to cast a spell on Tricia. "Why are you being so secretive about your Halloween costume?" asked Tricia one afternoon after school. "Just because," I said. "I want it to be a surprise." "We've always shared our Halloween costume secrets," said Tricia, a little hurt that I wasn't sharing my costume idea with her. "You will see it soon enough," I said. Tricia left in a huff, but it wasn't until she was gone that I remembered one Halloween that she dressed up as a clown, and she didn't tell me about it. I did feel guilty at first, but after remembering that, the guilt quickly vanished. I worked very hard on my costume, and then I had to come up with some kind of spell to put on Tricia. I didn't want the spell to be long-lasting or even devastating to her, just something to make her stop and think for a moment. I spent one afternoon in the public library checking out old books that were hidden away in a corner that not too many people knew about. I found one that had an old leather cover on it, and the pages inside it were covered in dust. The book had the word spells written by hand on the front of the book. There was a spell that would make someone into an agreeable person. From what I read in the details of the spell, it would make someone agree with everything you ever said to them for a matter of a full day. I read the ingredients I would need for the spell, and I was really surprised because they were just basic ingredients that anyone would find in their kitchen. I copied the spell and then went home to work on it. Halloween came and Tricia showed up a few minutes early. I came out of my bedroom in my costume. Oddly enough, Tricia had the almost exact costume that I had. "Great minds think alike," laughed Tricia. "Yes," I said, disappointed, "but you are missing the most important part." "What is that?" asked Tricia. "What am I missing?" "You are missing the spell," I said. "Oh," said Tricia, "that is where you are wrong. I do have a spell." Tricia flicked her arms around in the air, and she made some kind of strange gesture above my head. She then said some words in a language that I think she had made up. I laughed because I don't think Tricia had an actual spell. I think she made it up as she went. However, I tried to speak and I couldn't. My voice was gone. Tricia laughed the most sinister laugh I have ever heard. I tried to speak again. Nothing came out. I couldn't believe it. Tricia had successfully put a spell on me, and because I couldn't speak, I was not able to use my spell on her. She had me again. Pumpkin Race. "I don't want to go to the pumpkin race this year," I said.
"Why not?" asked Dad. "Melissa, I just don't get you sometimes."
"Halloween is supposed to be spooky," I said.
"Pumpkin races are lame."
"What can be spookier about watching pumpkins roll down the main street of town and splat all over the road?" said Dad.
"I guess that is a bit spooky," I said. "But the same thing happens every single year."
"Are you saying you want to be spooked?" asked Dad.
"Yes," I exclaimed, "I do."
"Okay," said Dad. "You come to the pumpkin race, and I will guarantee you will be spooked."
"All right," I said. "Whatever you got planned better be good and spooky."
"Oh, it will be," said Dad.
Dad went to work on an idea he had to make the pumpkin race spooky. I got ready and joined Dad at the pumpkin race.
"Melissa," said Dad, "so glad you decided to come."
"So I don't see anything spooky," I said.
"Oh, just you wait and see," said Dad, with a malicious grin on his face.
I waited for the pumpkin race to start, and everybody who had entered pumpkins in the race had them all lined up and ready to go. They were waiting for Dad to blow the whistle so they could start the race.
"Why aren't you blowing the whistle?" I asked Dad impatiently.
"Just wait," said Dad.
"That is all I am doing is waiting," I said. "I'm going home. This pumpkin race is the same as every other year."
I turned and started walking home, and just as I did, I saw something behind me. I saw a tall figure walking behind me, and it appeared that he had an axe in his hand.
"Okay," I yelled, "I am now spooked."
I ran to the nearest store and went inside and looked out the window. The man I saw went over to each pumpkin in the pumpkin race, and he started hacking away at the pumpkins, one by one. It was strange, but I didn't see orange guts like you would expect to find in a pumpkin. I saw red ones. I was terrified. Dad came and found me, and I was shaking.
"Well, you said you wanted something spooky," said Dad.
"Oh, yes," I said, "but I wasn't expecting something that spooky. And now look what that man has done to everyone's pumpkins." "I guess the pumpkin race is over."
"Not quite," said Dad. "They weren't the pumpkins everyone was using in the race. I had everyone fill a spare pumpkin full of ketchup so that it would look like blood."
"Oh, dear," I said.
"Yeah, I have a feeling that next Halloween you won't be asking for anything spooky," laughed Dad.
"No," I said honestly, "I think that was spooky enough for a lifetime."
Skulls on a Fence. I was upstairs doing my homework when I heard the most blood-curdling scream. It sounded like it was coming from outside. I got up from my desk and looked out my bedroom window, but I couldn't see a thing. It was too dark. I went downstairs, and my younger brother, Joey, had just walked in the front door. He looked like he had seen a ghost. His face was pure white.
"What happened?" I asked.
"I thought I heard someone screaming."
"That screaming was from me," said Joey. "Have you seen what is outside on the fence?"
"Oh, you mean the skulls?" I asked, laughing.
"Yes," said Joey. "The fence is lined with a million skulls." They scared the daylights out of me. Oh, Dad got them from the dollar store, I laughed. They're just Halloween decorations. Have you seen them all lit up? Joey asked. No, I admitted, I haven't. I put my shoes, and we went outside to the front lawn. I had to admit, the skulls did look pretty frightening. Dad had rigged up a light into each one of them so they shone brightly in the dark of the night.
Hey, do you boys like my skulls?
Asked Dad, who had just pulled up in the driveway. Wow, they sure are spooky, I said. Yeah, they spooked the daylights out of me, said Joey.
Georgie and Joey, said Dad.
Can you go open the door of the garage for me? Sure, Dad, I said. I went over to the garage door and Joey followed me. When I pulled the switch for the garage door to open, something spooky fell from the top of the garage and it flowed over to the big tree on our front lawn. Dad, I screamed, what was that?
I rigged up a witch to go from the garage over to the big tree, smiled Dad. It is for Halloween.
Do you have any other tricks we should know about? Asked Joey.
No, boys, laughed Dad. These two are the only ones. Can you boys come help me with the groceries? Asked Dad, opening the passenger seat of the car.
No deal, I said.
I promise there is nothing else, said Dad.
I went over to the passenger side of the car and grabbed a grocery bag from Dad and quickly went into the house with it.
I told you there was nothing more, said Dad.
I went into the kitchen and I set the grocery bag down on the counter. Meanwhile, Joey and Dad had just come into the kitchen and they set their bags on the counter. We started putting the groceries away and all of a sudden there was a loud screeching noise coming from the pantry.
Dad, Joey screamed. I thought you said you didn't do anything else.
I didn't, said Dad.
Both Dad and Joey looked at me, and I couldn't help but laugh. I had rigged up a tape recorder to play spooky music whenever anyone opened up the pantry door.
Well, at least we will be able to tell if anyone is in the pantry, laughed Dad.
Okay, here's a book written by Jerry Seinfeld, and it's simply titled Halloween. When you're a kid, you can eat amazing amounts of food. All I ate when I was a kid was candy. Just candy, candy, candy. And the only really clear thought I had as a kid was, get candy. Get candy. Get candy. Get candy. Family, friends, school, they were just obstacles in the way of getting more candy. So the first time you hear the concept of Halloween when you're a kid, your brain can't even process the idea. You're like, what is this? What did you say? Someone's giving out candy? Who's giving out candy? Everyone we know is just giving out candy? Oh, I gotta be part of this. Take me with you. I'll do anything they want. I can wear that. I'll wear anything I have to wear. I'll do anything I have to do to get the candy from those fools who are so stupidly giving it away. Well, the first couple of years, I made my own costumes. Ghost, hobo, the worst. I knew my destiny was to one day get a real Superman Halloween costume from the store. You know, the one, the cardboard box, the cellophane top, mask included in the set. Oh, baby. Remember the rubber band on the back of those masks? Yeah, that was a quality item. Thinnest gray rubber in the world. It was good for about 10 seconds before it snapped out of that cheap little staple they put it in there with. You go to the first house, trick or snap. It broke. I don't believe it. Wait up. I gotta fix it. You guys wait up. Kids don't want other kids to wait. They want them to wait up. Would you wait up? Because when you're little, your whole life is up. You want to grow up? Everything is up. Wait up. Hold up. Shut up. Mom, I'll clean up. Just let me stay up. When you're a parent, it's just the opposite. Everything is down. Just calm down. Slow down. Sit down. Come down here. Put that down. And keep it down in there. You're grounded. So the day finally came. I finally convinced my parents to buy me an official Superman Halloween store costume. I was physically ready, I was mentally prepared, and I absolutely believed when I put this costume on that I would look exactly like the Superman I had come to know on television and in the movies. Unfortunately, these costumes are not exactly the super fit that you are hoping for. You look more like you're wearing Superman's pajamas. It's all loose and flowy. The neckline comes down to about your stomach. You got that flimsy little ribbon string in the back holding it all together. Plus, my mother makes me wear my winter coat over the costume anyway. I don't recall Superman wearing a jacket. I read every comic book. I do not remember him ever once flying with a coat on. Not like the one I had. Cheap corduroy, phony fur. So you go out anyway, and the mask keeps breaking. The rubber band keeps getting shorter because you need to keep retying it. It's getting tighter and tighter on your face. Now you can't even see. You're trying to breathe through that little hole that gets all sweaty. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. The mask starts slicing into your eyeballs. I can't see. I can't breathe. But let's keep going. We gotta get that candy. About half an hour into trick-or-treating, you take that mask off. Ah, the heck with it. Bing bong. Yeah, it's me. Give me the candy. I'm Superman. Look at the red pant legs. Year after year, I never gave up on trick-or-treating. But I remember those last few Halloweens. I was getting a little too old for it. I was just kind of going through the motions. Bing bong. Come on, lady, let's go. Halloween, doorbells, candy. Let's pick it up in there. Well, they come to the door. They always ask you the same stupid question. What are you supposed to be? I'm supposed to be done by now. You want to move it along with the Three Musketeers? I got 18 houses on this block, sweetheart. You hit the bag, we hit the road. That's the way it works. Halloween three-step program. Step one, see kid. Step two, give candy. Step three, good night. Sometimes people give you the little white bag twisted on the top. You know that's gonna be some crummy candy. No official Halloween markings on it? I don't think so. Wait a second, what is this? The orange marshmallow shaped like a big peanut? Hey, do me a favor, you keep that one. We've got all the doorstops we need ahead. Thank you very much. We're going for name candy only this year. At the end of Halloween, I was able to fill a punch bowl so full of candy that the top of it would be curved. It was like a planet. And I would consume the entire thing that night. Next morning, I'd wake up, feel fantastic. And that's when I realized, when you're a kid, you don't need a costume. You are Superman.
And this is the Count reminding you that you are listening to the Halloween program again on Sun Sounds. So, for the remaining 30 minutes, I am going to read Roald Dahl's Book of Ghost Stories. And the story that I'm going to read is titled On the Brighton Road. And then it's Scary Stories Treasury. And if we have time, you will hear Halloween Scary Stories for Kids. Oh, let's get started.
On the Brighton Road. Slowly, the sun had climbed up the hard white downs, till it broke with little of the mysterious ritual of dawn upon a sparkling world of snow. There had been a hard frost during the night, and the birds, who hopped about here and there with scant tolerance of life, left no trace of their passage on the silver pavements. In places, the sheltered caverns of the hedges broke the monotony of the whiteness that had fallen upon the colored earth. And overhead the sky melted from orange to deep blue, from deep blue to a blue so pale that it suggested a thin paper screen rather than illimitable space. Across the level fields there came a cold, silent wind, which blew fine dust of snow from the trees, but hardly stirred the crested hedges. Once above the skyline, the sun seemed to climb more quickly, and as it rose higher, it began to give out a heat that blended with the keenness of the wind. It may have been this strange alternation of heat and cold that disturbed the tramp in his dreams, for he struggled for a moment with the snow that covered him, like a man who finds himself twisted uncomfortably in the bedclothes, and then sat up, staring, questioning eyes. "Lord, I thought I was in bed," he said to himself, as he took in the vacant landscape. "And all the while, I was out here." He stretched his limbs, and rising carefully to his feet, shook the snow off his body. As he did so, the wind set him shivering, and he knew that his bed had been warm. "Well, come, I feel pretty fit," he thought. "I suppose I am lucky to wake at all in this, or unlucky. It isn't much of a business to come back to." He looked up and saw the downs shining against the blue like the Alps on a picture postcard. "That means another 40 miles or so, I suppose," he continued grimly. "Lord knows what I did yesterday. Walked till I was done, and now I'm only about 12 miles from Brighton. Damn the snow, damn Brighton, damn everything!" The sun crept up higher and higher, and he started walking patiently along the road with his back turned to the hills. "Am I glad or sorry that it was only sleep that took me? Glad or sorry? Glad or sorry?" His thoughts seemed to arrange themselves in a metrical accompaniment to the steady thud of his footsteps, and he hardly sought an answer to his question. It was good enough to walk to. Presently, when 3 milestones had loitered past, he overtook a boy who was stooping to light a cigarette. He wore no overcoat and looked unspeakably fragile against the snow. "Are you on the road, Governor?" asked the boy huskily as he passed. "I think I am," the tramp said. "Oh, then I'll come a bit of the way with you, if you don't walk too fast. It's a bit lonesome walking this time of day." The tramp nodded his head, and the boy started limping along by his side. "I'm 18, he said casually. "I bet you thought I was younger." 15, I'd have said. Oh, you'd have backed a loser. 18 last August, and I've been on the road 6 years. I ran away from home 5 times when I was little, and the police took me back each time. Very good to me, the police was. Now I haven't got a home to run away from. Nor have I, the tramp said calmly. Oh, I can see what you are, the boy panted. You're a gentleman come down. It's harder for you than for me. The tramp glanced at the limping, feeble figure and lessened his pace. I haven't been at it as long as you have, he admitted. No, I could tell that by the way you walk. You haven't got tired yet. Perhaps you expect something. The other end? The tramp reflected for a moment. I don't know, he said bitterly. I'm always expecting things. Yeah, you'll grow out of that, the boy commented. It's warmer in London, but it's harder to come by grub. There isn't much in it, really. Still, there's a chance of meeting somebody there who will understand. Ah, country people are better, the boy interrupted. Last night, I took a lease of a barn for nothing and slept with the cows. And this morning, the farmer routed me out and gave me tea and toke because I was little. Of course, I score there. But in London, soup on the embankment at night and all the rest of the time, coppers moving you on. I dropped by the roadside last night and slept where I fell. It's a wonder I didn't die, the tramp said. The boy looked at him sharply. How do you know you didn't? He said. I don't see it, the tramp said after a pause. I'll tell you, the boy said hoarsely. People like us can't get away from this sort of thing if we want to. Always hungry and thirsty and dog-tired and walking all the time. And yet, if anyone offers me a nice home and work, my stomach feels sick. Do I look strong? I know I'm little for my age, but I've been knocking about like this for 6 years. And do you think I'm not dead? I was drowned bathing at Margate, and I was killed by a gypsy with a spike. He knocked my head right in. And twice I was froze like you last night. And a motor cut me down on this very road. And yet I'm walking along here now, walking to London to walk away from it again because I can't help it. Dead. I'll tell you, we can't get away if we want to. The boy broke off in a fit of coughing, and the tramp paused while he recovered. Well, you'd better borrow my coat for a bit, Tommy, he said. Your cough's pretty bad. You go to hell, the boy said fiercely, puffing at his cigarette. I'm all right. I was telling you about the road. You haven't got down to it yet, but you'll find out presently. We're all dead, all of us who were on it, and we're all tired, yet somehow we can't leave it. There's nice smells in the summer, dust and hay, and the wind smack in your face on a hot day. And it's nice waking up in the wet grass on a fine morning. I don't know. He lurched forward suddenly, and the tramp caught him in his arms. I'm sick, the boy whispered. Sick. The tramp looked up and down the road, but he could see no houses or any sign of help. Yet even as he supported the boy, doubtfully in the middle of the road, a motor car suddenly flashed in the middle distance and came smoothly through the snow. What's the trouble? Said the driver quietly as he pulled up. I'm a doctor. He looked at the boy keenly and listened to his strained breathing. Pneumonia, he commented. I'll give him a lift to the infirmary, and you, too, if you like. The tramp thought of the workhouse and shook his head. No, I'd rather walk, he said. The boy winked faintly as they lifted him into the car. I'll meet you beyond Rengate, he murmured to the tramp. You'll see, and the car vanished along the white road. All the morning the tramp splashed through the thawing snow. But at midday he begged some bread at a cottage door and crept into a lonely barn to eat it. It was warm in there, and after his meal he fell asleep among the hay. It was dark when he woke and started trudging once more through the slushy roads. 2 miles beyond Rengate, a fragile figure, slipped out of the darkness to meet him. On the road, Governor, said a husky voice. Then I'll come a bit of the way with you if you don't walk too fast. It's a bit lonesome walking this time of day.
But the pneumonia, cried the tramp aghast.
Oh, I died at Crawley this morning, said the boy.
Now, Scary Stories Treasury.
The Thing. Ted Martin and Sam Miller were good friends. They spent a lot of time together. On this particular night, they were sitting on a fence near the post office, talking about one thing and another. There was a field of turnips across the road. Suddenly, they saw something crawl out of the field and stand up. It looked like a man, but in the dark, it was hard to tell for sure. Then it was gone. But soon it appeared again. It walked halfway across the road. Then it turned around and went back into the field. Then it came out a third time and started toward them. By now, Ted and Sam were scared, and they started running. But when they finally stopped, they decided they were being foolish. They weren't sure what had scared them, so they decided to go back and get a better look. Pretty soon they saw it, for it was coming to meet them. It was wearing black pants, a white shirt, and black suspenders. Sam said, I'm going to try to touch it, then we'll know if it's real. He walked up to it and peered into its face. It had bright, penetrating eyes sunk deep in its head. It looked like a skeleton. Ted took one look and screamed, and again he and Sam ran, but this time the skeleton followed them. When they got to Ted's house, they stood in the doorway and watched it. It stayed out in the road for a while, then it disappeared. A year later, Ted got sick and died. Toward the end, Sam sat up with him every night. The night Ted died, Sam said he looked just like the skeleton. A New Horse. Two farmhands shared a room. One slept at the back of the room. The other slept near the door. After a while, the one who slept near the door began to feel very tired early in the day. His friend asked what was wrong. Oh, an awful thing happens every night, he said. A witch turns me into a horse and rides me all over the countryside. Well, I'll sleep in your bed tonight, his friend said. We'll see what happens to me. About midnight, an old woman who lived nearby came into the room. She mumbled some strange words over the farmhand, and he found he couldn't move. Then she slipped a bridle on him, and he turned into a horse. The next thing he knew, she was riding him across the fields at breakneck speed, beating him to make him go even faster. Soon they came to a house where a party was going on. There was a lot of music and dancing. They were having a big time inside. She hitched him to a fence and went in. While she was gone, the farmhand rubbed against the fence until the bridle came off, and he turned back into a human being. Then he went into the house and found the witch. He spoke those strange words over her, and with the bridle, he turned her into a horse. Then he rode her to a blacksmith and had her fitted with horseshoes. After that, he rode her to the farm where she lived. I have a pretty good filly here, he told her husband, but I need a stronger horse. Would you like to trade? The old man looked her over, and he said he would do it. So they picked out another horse, and the farmhand rode away. Her husband led his new horse to the barn. He took off the bridle and went to hang it up. But when he came back, the new horse was gone. Instead, there stood his wife with horseshoes nailed to her hands and feet. High beams. The girl driving the old blue sedan was a senior at the high school. She lived on a farm about 8 miles away and used the car to drive back and forth. She had driven into town that night to see a basketball game. Now she was on her way home. As she pulled away from the school, she noticed a red pickup truck following her out of the parking lot. A few minutes later, the truck was still behind her. "I guess we're going in the same direction," she thought. She began to watch the truck in her mirror. When she changed her speed, the driver of the truck changed his speed. When she passed a car, so did he. Then he turned on his high beams, flooding her car with light. He left them on for almost a minute. "He probably wants to pass me," she thought, but she was becoming uneasy. Usually, she drove home over a back road. Not too many people went that way, but when she turned onto that road, so did the truck. "Oh, I've got to get away from him," she thought, and she began to drive faster. Then he turned his high beams on again. After a minute, he turned them off. Then he turned them on again and off again. She drove even faster, but the truck driver stayed right behind her. Then he turned his high beams on again. Once more, her car was ablaze with light. "What is he doing?" she wondered. "What does he want?" Then he turned them off again. But a minute later, he had them on again, and he left them on. At last, she pulled into her driveway, and the truck pulled in right behind her. She jumped from the car and ran to the house. "Call the police!" she screamed at her father. Out in the driveway, she could see the driver of the truck. He had a gun in his hand. When the police arrived, they started to arrest him. But he pointed to the girl's car. "You don't want me," he said. "You want him." Crouched behind the driver's seat, there was a man with a knife. As the driver of the truck explained it, the man slipped into the girl's car just before she left the school. He saw it happen, but there was no way he could stop it. He thought about getting the police, but he was afraid to leave her, so he followed her car. Each time the man in the back seat reached up to overpower her, the driver of the truck turned on his high beams. Then the man dropped down, afraid that someone might see him. The Little Black Dog. Billy Mansfield said that a little black dog followed him wherever he went. But he was the only one who saw it, so people thought he was kind of crazy. To drive the dog away, Billy was always hollering at it, throwing rocks at it, but the dog always came back. The first time Billy saw that dog was the day he fought Silas Burton. Billy was just a young man then, but the Burtons and Billy's family had been feuding for years. When Billy saw Silas riding toward him, he went for his gun and Burton went for his. But Billy fired first. He hit Burton in the back, knocking him from his horse. Burton's horse ran off and his gun fell where he couldn't reach it. He lay there on the ground pleading with Billy not to kill him, but Billy killed him anyway. Burton's little black dog was with him when he was shot. The dog kept licking Burton's face and barking and snarling at Billy. In his anger, Billy killed the dog too. There wasn't much law enforcement in those days, so Billy wasn't arrested. But all that night, he heard Burton's dog outside his cabin, scratching on his door and barking to be let in. "I'm imagining this," Billy said to himself. "I shot that dog. It's dead." But the next morning, Billy saw the dog. It was waiting for him outside. From then on, there was not a day when he didn't see it. And there wasn't a night when he didn't hear it scratching on his door, barking to be let in. From then on, Billy was always finding black dog hairs on the sofa, on the floor, in his bed, even in his food. And the house and the yard stank of dog. That's what Billy said. Whenever somebody told him there wasn't any dog to see, he'd say, "Maybe you don't see it, but I do. And I'm not any crazier than you are." Things went on like that for many years. Then one morning, in the middle of the winter, the neighbors didn't see any smoke coming out of Billy's chimney. When they went over to check, Billy wasn't there. A day or so later, they found his body lying in the snow in a field back of his cabin. Billy had plenty of enemies, and at first it seemed like somebody might have killed him. But there wasn't a mark on his body, and there weren't any footprints out there except for Billy's. The doctor said Billy probably died of old age, but there was something odd about his death. When the neighbors found Billy, there were black dog hairs on his clothes. There were even a few on his face. It smelled like a dog had been out there. Yet no one had seen a dog anywhere. The Widow. Margaret and her brothers, Paul and David, shared a small house on top of a hill just outside the village. It was so warm one summer's night that Margaret could not sleep. She sat up in bed in the darkness of her room, watching the moon move across the sky. Suddenly, something caught her eye. She saw two small yellow-green lights moving through the woods near the graveyard at the bottom of the hill. They looked like the eyes of some animal, but she could not make out what kind of creature it was. Soon the creature left the woods and moved up the hill toward the house. For a few minutes, Margaret lost sight of it. Then she saw it coming across the lawn toward her window. It looked something like a man, and yet it didn't. Margaret was terrified. She wanted to run from her room, but the door was next to her window. She was afraid the creature would see her and break in before she could escape. When the creature turned and moved in another direction, Margaret rushed to the door. But before she could open the door, it was back. Margaret found herself staring through the window at a shrunken face like that of a mummy. Its yellow-green eyes gleamed like a cat's eyes. She wanted to scream, but she was so frightened that she could not make a sound. The creature broke the window glass, unlocked the window, and crawled inside. Margaret tried to flee, but the creature caught her. It twisted its long bony fingers into her hair, pulled back her head, and sank its teeth into her throat. Margaret screamed and fainted. When her brothers heard her piercing scream, they rushed to her room. But by the time they got the door unlocked, the creature had fled. Margaret lay on the floor, bleeding and unconscious. While Paul tried to stop the bleeding, David chased the creature down the hill toward the graveyard. But soon he lost sight of it. The police thought it was the work of an escaped lunatic who believed he was a vampire. When Margaret recovered, her brothers wanted to move to a safer place where it would be harder to break in. But Margaret refused. The creature would never come back. She was sure of that. But just in case, Paul and David began to keep loaded pistols in their rooms. One night, months later, Margaret was awakened by a scratching sound at the window. When she opened her eyes, there was the same shrunken face staring in at her. That night, her brothers heard her cries in time. They chased the creature down the hill, and David shot it in the leg. But the creature managed to scramble over the graveyard wall and disappeared near an old burial vault. The next day, Margaret and her brothers watched as the sexton of the church opened the burial vault. Inside was a horrifying scene. Broken coffins, bones, and rotting flesh were scattered all over the floor. Only one coffin had not been disturbed. When the sexton opened it, there lay the creature with the shrunken face that had attacked Margaret. The telltale bullet was in its leg. They did the only thing they knew of to rid themselves of a vampire. The sexton built a roaring blaze outside the vault and fed the shrunken body to the flames. They watched the body burn until nothing remained but ashes. Wonderful Sausage. One dark, rainy Saturday afternoon, a fat and jolly butcher named Samuel Blunt had an argument over money with his wife, Eloise. Blunt lost his temper and killed Eloise. Then he ground her up into sausage meat and buried her bones under a big, flat rock in the backyard. To keep the murder a secret, he told everyone that she had moved away. Blunt mixed his new sausage meat with pork, then seasoned it with salt and pepper, adding some sage and thyme and a bit of garlic. To give it a special flavor, he smoked it in his smokehouse for a while. He called it Blunt's Special Sausage. There was such a demand for this new sausage that Blunt bought the best hogs he could find and started raising his own pork. He also kept a sharp lookout for humans who might make a tasty sausage meat. One day, a nice, plump schoolteacher came into his shop. Blunt grabbed her and ground her up. Another time, Blunt's dentist came by. He was a little round man, and into the grinder he went. Then, one by one, the children in the neighborhood began to disappear, and so did their kittens and puppies. But no one ever dreamed that Blunt the butcher had anything to do with it. Things went on that way for years. Then one day, Blunt made a big mistake. A fat boy came into the butcher shop. Blunt grabbed him and started to drag him off to the sausage grinder. But the boy broke loose and ran out of the shop, and Blunt chased after him, waving a big butcher knife. When people saw this, they realized at once what had become of all the missing children and grown-ups and kittens and puppies. An angry crowd gathered at the butcher shop. No one knows for sure just what happened to Blunt that day. Some say he was fed to his hogs. Others say he was fed to his sausage grinder. But he was never seen again, and neither was his wonderful sausage meat. Just Delicious. George Flint loved to eat. Each day at noon, he closed his camera shop for 2 hours and went home for a big lunch. His wife, Minna, cooked for him. George was a bully, and Minna was a timid woman who did everything he asked because she was afraid of him. On his way home for lunch one day, George stopped at the butcher shop and bought a pound of liver. He loved liver. He would have Minna cook it for dinner that night. Despite all his complaints about her, she was a very good cook. While George ate his lunch, Minna told him that a rich old woman in town had died. Her body was in the church next door. It was in an open coffin. Anyone who wanted to see her could. As usual, George was not interested in what Minna had to say. "I've got to go back to work," he told her. After he left, Minna began to cook the liver. She added vegetables and spices and simmered it all afternoon, just the way George liked it. When she thought it was done, she cut off a small piece and tasted it. It was delicious, the best she had ever made. She ate a second piece, then a third. It was so good she could not stop eating it. It was only when the liver was all gone that she thought of George. He would be coming home soon. What would he do when he found that she had eaten all of the liver? Some men would laugh, but not George. He would be angry and mean, and she did not want to face that again. But where could she get another piece of liver that late in the day? Then she remembered the old woman lying in the church next door, waiting to be buried. George said he'd never had a better dinner. "Have some liver, Minna," he said. "It's just delicious." "No, I'm not hungry," she said. "You finish it." That night, after George had fallen asleep, Minna sat in bed trying to read, but all she could think about was what she had done. Then she thought she heard a woman's voice.
"Who has my liver?" it asked. "Who has it?"
Was it her imagination? Was she dreaming? Now the voice was closer.
"Who has my liver?" it asked. "Who has it?"
Minna wanted to run. "No, no," she whispered. "I don't have it. I don't have your liver." Now the voice was right next to her.
"Who has my liver?" it asked. "Who has it?"
Minna froze with terror. She pointed to George.
"He does," she said. "He has it."
Suddenly, the lights went out, and George screamed and screamed. Sam's new pet. Sam stayed with his grandmother when his parents went to Mexico for their vacation. "We are going to bring you back something nice," his mother told him. "It'll be a surprise." Before they came home, Sam's parents looked for something Sam would like. All they could find was a beautiful sombrero. It cost too much. But that afternoon, while they were eating their lunch in a park, they decided to buy the sombrero after all. Sam's father threw what was left of their sandwiches to some stray dogs, and they walked back to the marketplace. One of the animals followed them. It was a small, gray creature with short hair, short legs, and a long tail. Wherever they went, it went.
"Oh, isn't he cute?" Sam's mother said. "He must be one of those Mexican hairless dogs. Sam would love him."
"Well, he's probably somebody's pet," Sam's father said.
They asked several people if they knew who its owners were, but no one did. They just smiled and shrugged their shoulders. Finally, Sam's mother said,
"Maybe he's just a stray. Let's take him home with us. We can give him a good home, and Sam will love him."
Well, it's against the law to take a pet across the border, but Sam's parents hid the animal in a box, and no one saw it. When they got home, they showed it to Sam.
"Wow, he's a pretty small dog," said Sam.
"Well, he's a Mexican dog," his father said. "I'm not sure what kind. I think it's called a Mexican hairless."
"Well, we'll find out. But he's nice, isn't he?"
Well, they gave the new pet some dog food. Then they washed it and brushed it and combed its fur. That night, it slept on Sam's bed. When Sam awakened the next morning, his pet was still there.
"Mother," he called, "the dog has a cold."
The animal's eyes were running, and there was something white around its mouth. Later that morning, Sam's mother took it to a veterinarian.
"Well, where did you get him?"
the vet asked.
"In Mexico," she said. "We think he's a Mexican hairless. I was going to ask you about it."
"Well, he's not a hairless," the vet said. "He's not even a dog. He's a sewer rat, and he has rabies."
"Kids, that's all the time we have. Have a safe Halloween."
"Ow!"